Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. In Gabrielle Zevin's dystopian Birthright trilogy, we're brought into a world where chocolate and caffeine are illegal in America and supplies are run by the mob. Anya Balanchine is at the heart of the controversy. As the rising matriarch of the mob family, she's finally decided to accept the role and is determined to protect her siblings from the life. The second book in the series is Because It Is My Blood, and Anya's on the lam but is utilizing her time in hiding to learn more about the business and history of chocolate. But back in New York, the race for district attorney is heating up and the politicians are becoming just as corrupt as the mobsters.
Well, it's funny. I don't think they're maybe all that much more corrupt than in our contemporary New York or contemporary U.S. government. So I don't actually see them quite as, you know, villainous maybe as some people read them. I think they're trying to make the best of a bad situation, which is sort of fewer resources, less money, you know, and government officials do what they can. So I actually feel kind of sympathetic towards the government and all these things I've done, and Because It Is My Blood.
Really? Even though they're taking all these buy-offs and saying, well, what are you going to do for me if I help you out?
Well, I mean, I don't feel sympathetic for the people that are entirely corrupt, but for instance, Charles Delacroix, I feel a great deal of sympathy for him.
All right.
I think he's trying to do the best he can, mostly. He is a wicked man. Don't get me wrong.
But everybody's wicked in their own way in this series.
Yes, everybody is. But isn't that true, though, in life? I mean, most people are specifically wicked, you know?
Oh, that sounds so negative.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm trying not to be negative anymore. I'm trying to be more positive. But I do think I think people would be boring if they weren't a little bit wicked. I know book characters are. If you don't know, it's not that they have to be bad, but they have to, on some level, know what would be bad for them.
I think that the characters have to have that wickedness for this Birthright series, though. I mean, obviously, I don't think the books would be what they are without that.
Right. And I feel like that's really what the second book is about. I mean, it's called Because It Is My Blood, and I had a hard time getting to the title, though, strangely enough, I did always have the epigraph in the front, which is the Stephen Crane poem that ends, Because It Is Bitter, Because It Is My Heart. And I think it was really about Anya accepting her true nature, you know, and the fact that you kind of, in life, if you're, you know, dealt a hand of cards, you have to play that hand, you know. So I think that that was really what the book was about for me. Anya accepting her wicked nature. But is it her fault that people think she's wicked? Chocolate is illegal. What can she do?
And also, it is her destiny. I mean, this is the family that she has been brought up with. You can't turn your back on family.
No, you can't. I've been rereading Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, in which he talks about so much of life being determined sort of by the circumstances under which you're born. And I feel like for Anya, she can't turn her back on her family, but I don't think she could ever be happy if she did in another sense. So,
well, her family is her life, considering how many people she has lost already and having experienced all of the betrayal from the extended family. That's a massive burden on her, especially because her older brother, Leo, is MIA right now.
Right. And, you know, in a sense, she is these people. You know, she could try to, and I think the book is about this also, you know, that she could try to change her name, go to another place, but she would still be followed by that. And she's also miserable in a way in another place with a different name. So we don't want to get too spoilery, but yeah.
That's the thing. I think I like her better embracing her destiny rather than trying to change it.
Right. And, you know, in this sense, I feel like part of me for, you know, the first book, it was really about sort of, it really is a high school story, and it's really a typical coming-of-age story of Bildungsroman, her figuring out who she is and what is her place in the world. You know, but in the second book and in the third book, she really is a grown woman grappling with decisions that are going to affect her for the rest of her life.
And she is so protective over her siblings, especially Natty, who is her younger sister, and she wants to make sure that she does not have to go into the family business.
Right. But Natty is also a Balanchine, you know? Mm-hmm. So it might be sort of a futile pursuit for her. Like, Natty still has to also accept what her background is, you know? So I sometimes wonder Well, I don't sometimes, I guess I could say, because I know everything, I feel like such a genius, but I sometimes do wonder, like, whether Anya's struggle is just going to be a waste, ultimately. That was the thing. It'd be much better for her to be proactive in figuring out ways to work with, again, the hand she's been dealt.
Oh, see, that to me was always the beauty of Natty in this book, of how she has evolved as a person, having grown up in understanding what Anya has actually been doing to try to keep she and Leo safe. I feel like Natty is the one that could actually get out and have a real life outside of the Balanchine Empire.
But that's assuming that Anya survives, you know? And then, you know, if Anya was to say not survive, then Natty would have some problems. She would still have to deal with these people.
Oh, there's so much.
Sorry.
Darn
you.
Well,
you know, I mean, there's always been the question of from what, you know, Anya's a retrospective narrator. From where and from what is she telling the story is sort of the question that I hope will be answered by the time the series is through.
We meet some of our favorite characters, and obviously Wynn is back. And at first, we don't know in what capacity, because his father has said absolutely not, especially while he is running for office in New York City, because Anya represents everything he doesn't believe in.
But I think ultimately, you know, it's probably just, I think Charles Delacroix is deeply overreacting to what is a high school romance, you know, and later in the book, it is kind of revealed that his opponents kept pushing the story of Anya with the assistant DA's son because it really bothered Charles Delacroix. And I think rarely is there much to be gained from parents interfering with, and this is true in life, not just in future chocolate dystopias, but in life, rarely is much to be gained from trying to keep two high school lovers apart.
You push and they'll definitely pull.
And I don't really even feel, I feel like Wynn is attracted to Anya in a large part because of the fact that it annoys his father so much.
So I can see where this is going to go in the third book, if you take it on that premise.
Well, maybe. But I feel like, you know, most of us don't end up married to the boys we dated in high school. Some of us do. In fact, my parents, my mom and dad did end up married to each other, and they did meet in high school. But the larger portion of us have lots of high school boyfriends we leave behind. But I think that's the thing about, you know, young romance. It feels so intense at that moment. But the great thing for me about writing the series is that by the time the series is done, Anya, I think, is like 21 years old. And it's totally different to be 21 versus 16. Mm. And I actually didn't see it as, when I started writing the books, I didn't see it as sort of a grand romance. It's not Edward and Bella and Twilight, you know? Like, I saw Wynn as a boy that, of course, she was attracted to because he was nice to her, you know? Like, I don't think that romance has to be about a guy treating you badly, you know? But I didn't really see it as a grand romance. I saw it as the story of the rise of this female to power in a certain way.
And we see Anya changing, especially because the book takes us to Mexico and going back to the roots of the cacao tree. And that brings us to Theo and his family. And one thing I think she really begins to understand is the importance of staying with your family and understanding everything behind the family business.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, I think, the way in which, like, she just took for granted everything about chocolate. It was just this bad thing in her life. Daddy was in chocolate, but she really knew nothing about the plant, why it was illegal. And it was sort of a funny thing when people would read the first book, and I had written the second book before the first book came out, and they would say, why doesn't Anya, you know about why chocolate is illegal? Well, she didn't care at that point in her life. I mean, so I really felt like it was really important for her to go to, like, again, the source of chocolate. And you know, cacao is a fascinating crop, by the way. Just when I was doing the research, you know, they used to, when the Mayans would send out their soldiers to war, all they would give them was a cup of hot chocolate in the morning. That might just be kind of a wives' tale. But so it ended up being very interesting sort of research about chocolate, too, for me and for Anya. We both learned a lot about chocolate.
And that's certainly not a bad thing.
No. In fact, for the last year, my accountant would write off the chocolate I would eat. And it's because I've never been that much into chocolate. like I never really was a chocolate person. I always say I would be a lot worse off if it was a world in which bread was legal, because I love bread, but chocolate I could kind of live without. So for the last year when I would try, I've kind of grown an appreciation of different kinds of chocolate, and it's been a great research expense too. So
now there are so many great characters that we get to see more of in this book. And one of them is Simon Green, and he is Anya's lawyer's assistant.
Yes.
And we're not sure whether or not we like him yet.
Yeah, I mean, he was an interesting character to write the whole time, because he has, if you think about it, he has the most general name of anybody in the book, Simon Green. You know, he kind of could be like Joe Schmo. And so in a world where, like, you can tell a lot about people by their names. And I was always intrigued by him as a character from the moment he came on the stage in book one. And he was such a bad lawyer to Anya when he was filling in for Mr. Kipling. And I always wondered what was his story. And his story is very important. And yeah, there are a lot of lawyers in the book, and that's probably because when I started reading it, I was reading Bleak House by Charles Dickens, which is all about like a big lawsuit, and it takes all this time. And I do think lawyers are interesting characters, but somebody did point out to me that there were many, many lawyers. I think everybody I went to high school with became a lawyer too, so.
So it's always there in your mind.
Yes.
And then there's Yuji Ono, and he is part of the Japanese chocolate empire. And you had said in our first interview that you wanted to explore the different places. So this book took us to Mexico. Will the third book take us to Japan?
It does take us to Japan. And Yuji Ono is very important in the third book. And we also get to Russia, too. So a bit of a spoiler, I guess. But yeah, I really wanted to write a series where the staging took place in other than just America. Like, I love Hunger Games. I think it's a terrific book. But Panem seems to be basically the United States. And I don't know that that's a healthy attitude for young people to have when they're reading a book. We need to understand that the world is larger than just the events that happen in the U.S., that kind of myopia. So it was really important to me when I was writing the series to write it in lots of different places. So we're in Germany, we're in Russia, Japan, Mexico, possibly France.
And do you have any other spoilers that you can give our listeners about the third?
I don't know. I feel like I've just been spoiling everything. It's all a dream. No, I'm kidding.
For you, aside from Anya, which character's journey do you really feel connected to?
That is an interesting question. The truthful answer is probably not terribly sexy, but I sometimes relate very much to Charles Delacroix. And that's because I think, like, the older I get in life, the more I realize, like, just how hard it is to get things done, you know, how many compromises and things you have to do, really, to get things done. So I feel a great, and he is kind of the devil in a certain way in the book, so I feel a lot of sympathy for that devil. And other than that, I would say, I guess I'll just go with Charles Delacroix for now. Yeah.
I absolutely like him more in this book than in the first, but we see a more human side to him and not just through his son.
Yeah. And he is a grown man, but then that said, he's only in his early 40s, you know. When we're young and we read something, like, we think somebody in their 40s is a parent, that means they're done with life. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I was interested, and I think Anya exists in an adult world where she's in a way more comfortable even with adults. It's not like she was wildly popular in her high school. So I've had a lot of fun writing the various wicked adult characters. You know, I have to say, when I'm writing, I know I'm not doing it right if I don't feel a lot of sympathy for the villains. Like, obviously, say Gable Arsley at the beginning of book one, who is Anya's ex-boyfriend. Well, at the beginning of the book, he wasn't her ex-boyfriend, but becomes her ex-boyfriend. You know, I felt a lot of sympathy for him, even though he did something, from Anya's point of view at least, that was horrible. And I think if we don't really, again, figure out how the villains tick or what makes the villains tick. So the flip side of that, to bring it back to what we were saying at the beginning of our discussion, was if you don't figure out what's evil about the good people, you kind of don't have much going on with the characters. You know, I need to know what bad thing would any good character of mine do, and I need to know what good thing would any bad character of mine do.
I don't see any redeeming qualities to Gable. I can't. As far as I'm concerned, he totally could be killed off, and it would not bother me in the slightest.
He gets punished a lot. Well, you know what? The beginning of book three really begins with him getting extremely punished. More than he had. I mean, he's lost fingertips, for God's sake. He's had a hard time in his life, you know. But
yeah, but that's all his own doing.
That said, you have to think, like, at the beginning, I guess we should just say what we're talking about, which is that from Anya's point of view, Gable Arsley seems to want to date rape her at the beginning of the first book. But, you know, that said, this is all from Anya's point of view, and I think there is probably an extent to which Anya is very inexperienced with boys, you know? And, like, when you think about the practicalities of what she thinks Gable is going to do, I'm not sure that, you know, he would have done that, you know, but who knows? But he also did say horrible things about her brother. He's a generally terrible character, it's true, but I do feel some sympathy for him.
The name of the book is Because It Is My Blood. It is the second in the Birthright trilogy. Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Again, Gabrielle Zevin's second novel in the Birthright series is Because It Is My Blood. It is published by FSG. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Hello. I fight these animals alone until I get home.